like whodunits, I must confess to a certain personal enjoyment of them, especially the classical Agatha Christie type, where, you know, the murder takes place in a vast Tudor mansion, with secret corridors and shifty-eyed butlers, where suspicion falls, for one reason or another, on just about everybody, and where the final denouement involves the entire household assembling in the library so that the sleuth can reconstruct the crime and unravel the mystery with masterly genius. Novels like that, I find, are not just a challenge to your powers of logic and observation. They're a great test of psychological insight. What is it that could possibly make an otherwise sane and congenial individual commit homicide? What proportion of the population do you think could perpetrate such a crime? Perhaps most searching of all, are there any circumstances in which I could end up as one of those suspects in the library? Would a master detective regard me as a potential murderer? Well, at the risk of being perhaps a little fanciful, this morning I want to suggest to you that Luke, the evangelist, has a rather similar question to put to all of us. See, he's about to recount one of the most brutal and unpardonable killings of all time. The victim is a totally innocent young man without the minutest stain on his character. But even though his murder was perpetrated in broad daylight and with hundreds of witnesses, not a single finger was lifted to prevent it. Not a single voice was raised in protest. And the question Luke is quietly asking as he records this barbaric crime is quite simply, who done it? Who was responsible for this murder? Who is to blame for the death of Jesus Christ? It's important to remember when you read the Gospel accounts of the first Good Friday that the evangelists are first and foremost storytellers, not diarists. It's clear there was an awful lot of coming and going that day. Jesus was arraigned, both formally and informally, before the Roman and Jewish authorities on at least four or five different occasions. And each of the four Gospel writers had access to various sources of information about those hearings, and each has been highly selective in what they chose to record so as to maintain the dramatic pace of their plot. What Luke has done, to my mind, with all the narrative skill of an Agatha Christie, is to summon all the major participants in the action of that fatal day, one by one, and give us a kind of cameo portrait of their role in this complex sequence of events. First of all, there are the soldiers. Then there's the Jewish hierarchy, the Sanhedrin. And then there are the politicians, Pilate, Herod. Clearly somewhere in this chain, the guilt must lie. Judicial murder of this magnitude can't be left unsolved. Somebody must take the rap. Which of them is it to be? But the interesting thing is that Luke, in answer to his most emotive of all whodunits, points the accusing finger at everybody in general, but never points it at anybody in particular. There is no satisfying denouement to this mystery. The culprit is never identified. He gives us no scapegoat. Instead, he leaves us with the distinct impression that these characters in his murder mystery are not so much suspects, but accomplices. Accomplices in a monstrous conspiracy to which no one can plead innocent. Not even us. His readers. And that's why I've called our study this morning, Were You There? Let's survey Luke's list of accessories before the fact then together and ask ourselves, where would I have been if I'd been there that first Good Friday? We'll start with the soldiers in verses 63 to 65 of chapter 22. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanding, prophesy who hit you. And they said many other insulting things to him. Doesn't take much imagination to guess what was going on. Here, Joe, we can have a bit of fun with this one. Supposed to be the Messiah, is he? Well, let's see how good he is at prophecy. Blindfold him and see if he can tell the name of the one who slaps his face. That should be good for a laugh. It's clear from the gospel records that every time Jesus was left in the charge of the military, between these many trials he faced that night, he was subjected to this kind of vulgar abuse. In chapter 22 here, it's the temple guard involved. In chapter 23, verse 11, we find Herod's soldiers doing something similar, dressing him up in a posh robe like the king of the Jews he was supposed to be. And Matthew and Mark tell us that the Roman legionnaires, to whom he was eventually handed over, engaged in much the same kind of macabre vaudeville. In their case, putting a purple cloak on him and a crown of thorns on his head and a pole in his hand as a mock scepter, such as the Roman nobility might carry. Awe, Caesar, they saluted him. Hail, King of the Jews. Before they spat on him and struck him. I suppose you could say it was all just crude horseplay. But their vicious contempt for the feelings of their victim and the gratuitous violence that accompanied all their taunts and their jibes, that can't really be excused, can it? It's one thing for soldiers to carry out brutal orders. It's altogether another for them to revel in that brutality in this sadistic manner. No, we can hardly hold the soldiers innocent of blame. The question we have to ask is, would we have been any different? Or would some of us here this morning have been numbered among them if we had been there? Is this kind of behavior something we've grown above now that we're in the 20th century and sophisticated and civilized? I suggest to you we are hopelessly naive if we think it is. Opinions differ, of course, about the origins of violence in society. Some say it's a hangover of man's evolutionary past, a residuum of animal aggression that's not yet been purged out of our genetic code. Some say it's a learned behavior. We program it into our children by teaching them to fight, by giving them guns to play with and showing them war films on television. Marxists say it's all environmental, a response to social and economic deprivation, and can be eliminated by the welfare state. Freudians say it's all instinctual, an expression of innate psychological drives within the individual that can never be eliminated without simultaneously destroying man's creativity. But what nobody is in any real doubt about is that violence today is increasing. In the USA, the FBI has reported that the chance of being murdered or raped or assaulted tripled in the 16 years between 1960 and 76, the last statistics I could lay hands on. Charles Silberman, in his book Criminal Violence, Criminal Justice, observes that if the current rates of increase continue, then 3 Americans out of every 100 will be the victims of violent crime each year. He predicted that in 1978. The rate now, I understand, is closer to 4. And as for Britain, a cursory glance at our official statistics presents a similarly horrific picture, with murders more than doubling in the last 25 years, and woundings and assaults increasing by an incredible factor of nearly 1,000% in that time. Even this past week, this appalling attack on Michael Saywood's home in Ealing has brought these ugly statistics into front page prominence. And Douglas Hurd's comments to the Conservative Party this week were scarcely radically optimistic about the likelihood of reversing the trend. And yet some of us still maintain this arrogant delusion, don't we, that in comparison to the ancient world we are civilized and enlightened. We have progressed beyond the barbarisms of the past to a new humane and compassionate society that believes in the sanctity of life. What waddle? What humanistic mythology? No century since the foundation of the world has ever seen so many millions of human beings slaughtered in war as ours has. No ancient society ever eliminated unborn children in such quantities, with such ruthless efficiency, and with such total lack of moral conscience as ours does. And as far as violence is concerned, I assure you what we have in the 20th century is not humanity at all, but mere sentimentality. Like the man who said, "I can't stand cruelty to animals." I think any man who's cruel to animals should be shot like a dog. No, violence isn't reducing in our society at all. And neither evolution, nor education, nor the welfare state, nor the psychological studies of criminologists are going to reduce it. That was the tragic irony of the murder of Olaf Palme. It would be so nice to believe that humanitarianism and reason could make of us a non-violent world, but it can't. And the assassin's bullet that killed him proved it. Violence is as old as Cain and Abel and as intractable. And that's why we can't point the finger at these soldiers in any superior fashion. The mockery and the beatings to which they submitted Jesus, you can find going on 100 inner city street corners today. And would some of us have been there, do you think? Numbered among those rowdy thugs? There are plenty of members of our so-called civilized 20th century who would have been, without a shadow of a doubt, there. Behind this cloak of our sophistication, the bully boys who enjoy beating the daylights out of a fellow human being are still around. And as in Jesus' day, they aren't all confined to the criminal fraternity, you know. Some of them are in the employ of the state. If we wanted to execute someone by crucifixion, we wouldn't have much difficulty in finding people willing to bang the nails in. Some within our armed forces and police would regard it as a real pleasure to be of such service to the nation. Is it possible we would have been among them? Not all of us, of course. Some of us are far too bright and middle class to be numbered among such thugs, aren't we? Perhaps then we would have been with the next group in Luke's catalogue of suspicion. The Jewish hierarchy. Look at verses 66 and following of chapter 22. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. If you're the Christ, they said, tell us. The full council, or Sanhedrin as it's technically called, numbered 70, but it's possible the Gospels are actually referring to a small, a kind of executive committee within that larger body when they speak of the council of the elders here. But whoever they were and however many there were of them, Luke leaves us in no doubt as to the distinguished offices and pedigrees that they had. They were the elders of the people, he says, the chief priests and the teachers of the law. In other words, they were the representatives of the political, the religious and the academic establishment in Jerusalem. What we would call MPs, diocesan bishops, and university professors. One would have thought that so prestigious a body would have been, could have been relied upon to act with integrity in a matter like this, but alas, not so. Luke has already told us that it was this very same group who had conspired with Judas to get Jesus arrested in the first place. And now they had achieved their goal. There was no way they were going to allow any scruples about a fair trial to permit him to slip through their fingers. Matthew and Mark both tell us that a number of witnesses had been set up, with malice aforethought, to provide the legal evidence necessary for Jesus' conviction. But unfortunately, their stories never agreed. And even this prejudiced court couldn't cover up the discrepancy, so reluctantly the witnesses had to be dismissed. And it was the failure of this independent evidence against Jesus that led Caiaphas the high priest and others there to put Jesus on oath and interrogate him directly, as Luke reports for us here. If you are the Christ, they said, tell us. Almost certainly the question was put in a form which it was legally obligatory to answer. And that's why Jesus breaks the silence he'd maintained up till this point. His answer, you see, is threefold. If I tell you, you will not believe me. In other words, there's no real point in answering truthfully of that question, because this court has already made up its mind to reject my claims, and so any honest reply will simply be self-incriminating. Secondly, and if I asked you, you would not answer. Here he's pointing out that the legal right of a defendant in Jewish law to cross-examine his accusers in order to prove his case was useless to him, since this court was not prepared to engage in the kind of serious theological discussion necessary to establish his claims. But then thirdly, he drops his bombshell. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. He's conflating here two verses, well known to these high-ranking Jewish scholars, one from Daniel 7, the other from Psalm 110, and he's strongly hinting that their messianic expectations were about to be fulfilled, and when they were, the roles would be reversed, and it would be he, Jesus, who would be sitting on the judgment throne, not them any longer. The court is scarcely able to believe that Jesus would so brazenly provide the very grounds for his conviction they were seeking. So they press the point. You mean you are the Son of God then? Some have argued that Jesus' reply to this was actually more evasive than our translation suggests. Because literally he says, you are the ones saying that I am. But I think there can be little doubt that whatever the original Aramaic Jesus used was, it must have been an idiomatic way of replying in the affirmative, just as perhaps we sometimes say, you said it, meaning it's true. Mark's Gospel certainly takes it that way, for he records Jesus' answer simply as, I am. And his inquisitors seem to be in no doubt about the positive implications of his response either, do they? Even though Luke may be suggesting that they have deliberately missed the point of Jesus' emphasis on the fact that it was they who used the phrase Son of God, not he. Why do we need any more testimony, they asked. We have heard it from his own lips. Well, almost they had. A mockery of a trial, this thing. Almost certainly irregular in its proceedings. Utterly unfair in its mode of interrogation. And hopelessly prejudiced in its verdict. But was it so very different, do you think? From the kind of thing that might just as easily have happened today? Is it impossible that some of us, if we'd have been there, would have been numbered with this bigoted Sanhedrin? It's always a dangerous thing, you know, when religious people think they have distilled the absolute truth. And it's a doubly dangerous thing when such self-appointed guardians of orthodoxy wield some measure of political power. Because in circumstances like that, heretics always get a raw deal. Now, I'm not denying that heresy is dangerous. And the church cannot afford to allow false ideas to go unchallenged, or the very nature of truth is blurred in people's minds. But I do suggest to you that the only safe way to oppose such error in the church is by refuting it, never by repressing it. The reason for this is quite simple. Until you have examined a heretic's ideas very carefully and with a very open mind, you can never be sure whether he is a true heretic or a prophet in disguise. And if you make a habit of executing the former, you are likely to find yourself crucifying the latter as well. See, heretics and prophets have one thing in common. They are both subversives. They both threaten the status quo by their thoughts. And the trouble is, when the reins of power are in the hands of those who have a vested interest in the maintenance of the status quo, it is all too tempting to take the shortcut of repression rather than to engage in the much more demanding and possibly unsettling task of theological refutation. This, of course, is what was responsible for the great disaster of Catholicism in the 16th and 17th centuries. Catholicism believed it had the truth, the infallible truth. Any contradiction of its dogma had, by definition, to be heresy. And since Catholicism had access to the power of the sword in a great many European nations, it was not difficult to eliminate those who questioned her doctrine. Thus, orthodoxy became bigotry, and bigotry became intolerance. And intolerance became the Inquisition. Would that one could say that Protestantism, in its rebellion against Catholic dogma, learned the danger of such tactics, but I fear it didn't, not totally. The poor Anabaptists were persecuted as mercilessly by Calvin as they were by the papacy, and for the same reason, you see. Where the state and church join hands, heresy becomes treason, and free inquiry a capital crime. Are we free, I wonder, from such repressive and intolerant attitudes today? Sometimes I fear that those Christians amongst us who like to style themselves reformed are, in point of fact, the most incapable of reformation. For just like 16th century Catholicism, they are sure they are right. Their systematic analysis of correct doctrine is the divine truth, and any contradiction of it is arrogant and blasphemous attack on God himself. There can be no prophets for such inflexible minds, only heretics. And so, constrained by their intellectual funnel vision, they conduct their witch hunts as blindly and as mercilessly today as did the Spanish Inquisition 300 years ago or the Sanhedrin 2,000 years ago. Do you know, I believe some of them are so blinkered in their thought processes, so blindly intolerant of any who differ from them, so utterly convinced of the infallibility of their position, I believe they might even have regarded Jesus as unsound and voted the death penalty for him. Would some of us have been amongst them, do you think? Or maybe we're not religious types. Maybe we haven't had any theological education and make no pretenses to be great churchgoers. Maybe it's with the politicians, then, that we feel more identity. Pilate and Herod. Let's look at them in chapter 23. The whole assembly rose and led Jesus off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be the Christ, the King." According to the Jewish writer Philo, Pilate was a cruel and arbitrary tyrant, and there's no doubt from the record of his atrocities during his 10-year governorship that he does seem to have been a pretty nasty piece of work. Some have argued that his reluctance to order Jesus' execution in this chapter seems inconsistent with the historical evidence about him. Maybe Luke has biased his account in favour of the Romans in order to make Christianity more acceptable to his Gentile readership. Well, I think that's the most unlikely point of view, really. After all the Gospel writers agree that Pilate sought to release Jesus, and they weren't all pro-Roman. Anyway, it's not difficult to find reasons for Pilate's attempted leniency. For a start, the Romans were notoriously superstitious, and Matthew records that Pilate's wife had had an ominous dream about Jesus the night before his trial, and had sent word to Pilate not to get mixed up in the affair. That alone might have made him wary. Another consideration is that Pilate was almost certainly impressed by Jesus as a person. John, in his Gospel, records a fascinating private interview between the two of them. Sometimes one isn't quite sure in that interview who is interrogating whom. There can be little doubt that a man of Pilate's education and experience knew the difference between a troublemaker and a philosopher, and Jesus, to his mind, was clearly the latter. But perhaps the most important influence on Pilate's conduct of this trial was his own bitterly anti-Semitic sentiments. We know he detested the Sanhedrin and all they stood for, and he was quite shrewd enough to realize that they were the last people to bring a genuine anti-Roman agitator to him. No, these trumped-up charges of subversion and tax rebellion were clearly just a cover for the real thing they had against this man, which was bound to be something to do with their petty and revolting little religion. Frankly, if Jesus was an enemy of the Sanhedrin, he had Pilate's fullest sympathies. So if Pilate was moved to be lenient towards Jesus, it was far more likely to be out of a desire to snub these obstreperous and pompous Jews than from any high-minded concern about Jesus' innocence. Nevertheless, for whatever reason, it is clear that Pilate did want to release Jesus. And on that ground, I suppose we could argue he's less guilty than others in Luke's catalogue of blame. Some Christian traditions actually make a hero of Pilate, you know. But unfortunately, when you look the gospel records in the face, it's clear that Pilate lacked the courage of his convictions. He allowed himself to be browbeaten by the Jews, and that rather diminishes any grounds for mitigation of his offence. Three times, you see, he announces the verdict, not guilty. In verse 4, again in verse 14, and then in verse 22. But for any judge worth his salt, three times is two times too many, isn't it? All he had to do was dismiss the case. Instead, he persistently tries to appease these Jews and finally surrenders to them. Pilate decided to grant their demand, verse 24. He released the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, and the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. Surrendered is just about the word. As before, critics have argued that such indecisiveness is not typical of the Pilate to whom history bears witness. So again, Luke must be trying to do a snow job on this Roman's complicity in the affair. But once again, I think there may very well be an explanation for Pilate's uncharacteristic deference towards the Jews and their opinions. If the date of the crucifixion was, as many people think, 33 AD, then Tiberius, the Roman emperor, had recently executed a great friend and patron of Pilate called Sejanus. So it may very well have been that Pilate considered his position as governor rather vulnerable at this time. He may have felt that any kind of Jewish unrest was unlikely to improve his reputation in Rome, or the likelihood of a continuation of his contract in Jerusalem. So he may have felt he wasn't in a sufficiently strong position to risk a major Jewish insurrection because of this man Jesus. No matter how much he would have liked to have thwarted the Sanhedrin, it may be he felt politically outmaneuvered on this occasion. Jesus would have to go. The price of his political career. Unless, of course, he could pass the buck. He did try that, didn't he? That's where Herod came in verse 6. On hearing that Jesus had started in Galilee, he asked if he was a Galilean, and when he learned that he was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod. Now, this Herod was the son of the famous Herod the Great, who appears in the Nativity story with the wise men. He was the one who executed John the Baptist, of course, and that may have been the reason Jesus was so silent and surly in his presence. He had little respect for this petty monarch. He himself had disdainfully called him a fox not so long before, you remember. But it's clear that Herod had some measure of respect for Jesus, as indeed he'd had for John the Baptist too. He seems to have been the kind of man, you see, that regards religion as a form of entertainment. Mark tells us he kept John the Baptist in prison, but brought him out every now and again to preach in his court because he, quote, liked to listen to him. And apparently he was curious about Jesus' reputation as a miracle worker in much the same way. Come and do one of your party tricks, Jesus. I want to be amazed. It was the demand of a spoiled brat, wasn't it? He hoped to see him perform some miracle. The bored thrill-seeker, eager to explore anything new for kicks. He had no real interest in who Jesus was or what became of him, but if he could amuse him, he might take him on as court jester, just as he'd done with John. Indeed, when it became clear that Jesus had no intention of cooperating with his desire for sport, he decided to turn him into a clown, didn't he? He and his soldiers too. And if nothing else, he could always make a little political capital out of his exchange with the governor of Judea. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. The word for Herod's attitude to life, of course, is hedonism. Hedonism means do what you enjoy. Treat everything as a game. It's the philosophy of the playboy. And many a person has toyed with Jesus in the same way Herod did. For fun. Finished up crucifying him for fun. The word for Pilate's attitude to life, on the other hand, is pragmatism. Pragmatism says don't worry too much about right and wrong. Do what works. do what's most expedient. It's the creed of most politicians, you'll find. Jesus was not the first, nor by a very long chalk would he be the last innocent man to be sacrificed on the altar of somebody's career, or to be eliminated in so-called interests of national security. The fact is, of course, that the one thing that God put civil government on this earth to defend was the one thing that never seriously entered either Pilate's or Herod's head, namely justice. There was no basis for any capital charge against Jesus. Pilate admits it 3 times. And no amount of water can wash away the blood that stains the hand of any man who, knowing that, still signs a death warrant. John F. Kennedy commented on Dante's Inferno once and pointed out that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, like Pilate, in times of great moral crisis, try to maintain their neutrality. Could it be that some of us would have done just the same? Is it not true that, like Pilate and Herod, what prevents us from publicly taking Jesus' side is that we're afraid of the crowd? We're afraid of what the family will say, or our school friends will say, or what our colleagues will say. We're afraid of what it will cost us in our career or in our home life. We want to enjoy ourselves, and we want to be practical. Hedonism and pragmatism, that's our philosophy too. They're the hallmark of all moral cowards. And I assure you there were plenty of them surrounding that cross the first Good Friday. Would you have been one of them? Here they are then, the suspects in the library, the sadistic soldiers who executed the crime, the sanctimonious priesthood who conspired for it, the corrupt politicians who acquiesced to it. Who do you think is the murderer? Am I not right when I say they all are? And am I not right, too, when I say if we had been there, we would have done the same? Some of us would have joined the soldiers, some of us would have plotted with the priests, and some of us would have conspired with the politicians. And as for the rest of us, those of us who have no violent streak, no political clout, no religious pretensions, you know where we would have been? The answer is obvious. We would have been in the crowd, wouldn't we? The crowd is the last in Luke's catalogue of complicity. If blame falls anywhere, it falls on them. Pilate called the chief priests, the rulers, and the people. On the surface, it seems strange that Jesus' popularity with the people should have deteriorated so rapidly, doesn't it? These, after all, were presumably the same people who'd welcomed him into the city not a week before. But those who know a little of the psychodynamics of crowd behaviour won't be surprised at the volatility of their affection. The Jewish masses, remember, were looking for political freedom. And for a while, perhaps, they thought that this Jesus intended to give it to them. When it became clear that he hadn't even put up a fight against arrest, and that the Roman governor, for some suspicious reason, even seemed to be wanting to protect him, their loyalty for him was easily dissolved, like the fickle whim it was. And it was replaced by that contempt which the mob reserves for those leaders who disappointed. "Not this man. Release Barabbas to us," they shouted. Mark explains to us that it was the custom at Passover time for the Roman governor to grant an amnesty towards any prisoner of the people's choice. But I guess Pilate must have been furious at their citation of Barabbas for this honour in preference to Jesus. For Barabbas was a notorious assassin and revolutionary. In all likelihood, he had been sentenced for crucifixion the following day with 2 of his equally violent colleagues. That's why there were 3 crosses standing there. So handy. That this partisan mob should call for the release of a proven terrorist and in the same breath demand the blood of a man whose only crime was that he refused to satisfy their revolutionary ambitions for him. That was the height of irony. But mobs do that kind of thing. You think of a football crowd at Brussels, or a lynching mob in Soweto, or think of a riot in Brixton. Crowds display a kind of collective behaviour in which all sense of personal responsibility is overruled by corporate frenzy. And the result is that individuals shout things and do things which in isolation they would never have dreamed of doing. Heil Hitler, they shout. Out Black, they shout. Crucify him, they shout. And while they shout, and while they perpetrate their irrational atrocities, there is always that much larger crowd sitting at home, watching them do it on TV, and going, tut, tut, what a good job I didn't go into the city today. Millions of people who don't like controversy, who spend their time in the pub, not with the mob, who stand at policy when confronted with any issue of public morality, don't get involved, it isn't your business, look after number one, you've got your health to think about, keep your head down or it might get blown off. Anything for a quiet life, anything. The silent majority, they're often called today, aren't they? But you see, there are times when silence is no excuse. The triumph of evil in this world requires nothing more than that good men say nothing. All right, maybe we may comfort ourselves that we wouldn't have been with the soldiers, that we wouldn't have been with the Jewish hierarchy, we wouldn't have been with the political aristocracy. Maybe we even think we wouldn't have been with that mob crying for blood, but we would have been there. By our action, or perhaps by our silence. Consenting to his death. And what's more, we are still there. Every time we come to a church like this one, every time we see this man, Jesus, walking his lonely path to the cross and turn our back on him, we're there once again. Every time we spurn his love, every time we refuse his grace, every time we say to ourselves, don't get involved with that Jesus crowd, then we join our voices with that Good Friday mob. Every time we close our ears to his cries, our hearts to his appeal, we crucify him afresh. If not on the cross of our hate, then on the even crueler cross of our apathy. Oh yes, we were there. It's an awful thing, isn't it, to think that people like us could crucify anyone, let alone the Son of God. But we did. We can't point the finger at anybody. It may not have been our actual hands that drove the nails through his body, but we are part of the world that did it. And our hearts are no less wicked, and our motives no more pure, and our society no more humane. We need to hear, just as much as they did, that tender voice speaking from the very cross where we put him and say, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Let's pray together.